From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. This year, Ken Burns, one of the preeminent documentary filmmakers, turned his lens on the last remaining North American megafauna, the American buffalo. The film premiered on PBS, spanning 4 hours over two nights this fall. Let's listen to the trailer.
My people in the buffalo have a shared history together.
The buffalo was sacred, and they could not imagine existence without the buffalo.
They were put on this earth to help us survive.
To think that our greed and our industrialization would blink this thing out.
This is the buffalo's last chance.
They've survived, we've survived, we both persisted.
The film has Burns' usual mix of beautiful nature footage, archival photographs, and deep interviews with experts, many of whom are Native Americans. Later on in the program, we'll hear from one of them, Rosalyn LaPierre, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois. But first, Burns himself. It would be difficult to understate Burns' importance in teaching Americans about themselves. The historian Stephen Ambrose once said, "More Americans get their history from Ken Burns than any other source." I spoke with Burns in October. As always, you can let us know what you think about our program by emailing talk@21stshow.org. Ken Burns, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for making the time to talk with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Why the American buffalo?
Well, it's the national mammal. It's the largest land mammal in North America. It's at the heart, though, much more importantly, about a very complicated, at times tragic, at times uplifting story of the United States. It obviously engages those hundreds of native tribes, nations, that had an intimate relationship with this animal for sustenance and for spirituality for 10, 12,000 years. And it's also the story of the people who, in just a few generations, brought that animal to the brink of extinction, and the collective group of people, both Native and American, or white American, who brought it back from the brink of. It's about as complicated a story I know. It is one of the deepest tragedies. In fact, it is part of the slaughter of the buffalo is part of the largest murder of wildlife in the history of our planet. And it's on our watch. And I think we have to ask ourselves some pretty tough questions about, you know, where we got to that and why we permitted market pressures and also our dislike for Native people to promote the slaughter of the buffalo. I can't imagine a more important topic.
And I want to unravel some of those threads as we go on, but it strikes me that the national symbol of America is the eagle. Would you make a case for the bison?
The eagle is a national bird. I think the bison sort of is emotionally closer to us. There's something, you know, the bald eagle has been around there, but it was recently named the national mammal. And it was interesting that as the frontier closed, as people began to have identity crisis about what Americans were, that this continent that Thomas Jefferson told Lewis and Clark it would take 100 generations to fill up had been filled up in 3 or 4. There's a real anxiety about who we are, and we created a nickel in 1913 with a Native American on the front and a buffalo on the back. We know who the Native American is. The buffalo was a guy called Black Diamond. The sculptor Fraser said, "I wanted to make a coin that wouldn't be mistaken for any other country's coin." So the Native American and the buffalo were the symbol of us, U.S. and us, in a kind of intimate way of identity. And yet that buffalo was sent down to the meatpacking district in Manhattan and slaughtered. And we know what basically, we'd spent the last century trying to get rid of both groups. And so there's an interesting kind of romanticizing of something we tried to get rid of, and fetishizing, maybe. Maybe there's a pang of conscience. I think if anybody who's ever seen a buffalo up close, you know there is just an instantaneous sense of majesty. You look in their eyes and they seem to see in all different directions. And you begin to see what was severed, the trauma that took place across the plains as tribes were separated from this animal that they used everything from the tail to the snout and part of their religious beliefs, sometimes at the very heart of their religious beliefs in some tribes. And then they watched white people come in and just slaughter just for the hide, leaving 800 pounds of meat, the head, the horns, the hoofs, to rot on the prairie until they couldn't find any. We think there were 70 million before Columbus, at least 35 million when Lewis and Clark stepped out on to the plains in the early 1800s. And by 1885, nobody could find one. We think there were maybe 1,000, under 1,000, in zoos and in corrals and maybe a handful running wild and free. That's slaughter on a scale the world has never seen before.
That raises the point about how you made this film. And it's notable when you're watching it that you worked to include, or even I guess the term people use now is to center, Indigenous voices. Talk about that decision and that process.
Well, I think it's possible. I mean, I don't even know. To include, to not include would be like not taking a picture of the buffalo. You know, I mean, you can't make a film about the buffalo without showing the buffalo. You can't make a picture of the buffalo without showing Native Americans, or by extension, us as the perpetrators of this unbelievable story or tragedy. I think we spend a lot of time paying lip service to other people's points of view, and then we say other, and then we've othered them. These are the original Americans. Of course, they are as American as you and I, perhaps even more so by virtue of the fact they've been here for 600 generations, and we've maybe been here for 5 or 6, 7, 8, however many it is. And I think that when we do that, even with the best of intentions, we sort of continue to other. And that paternalistic or even patronizing point of view just won't stand. And so it was our intention to very much permit Native American voices, and not singular Native American voices. There's 300 nations in the continental United States. To say they all think alike is to promote the worst sort of notions of white supremacy. So yeah, of course, they've got to be a huge part of it. And there are different tribes from the Mandan Hidatsa what is now North Dakota, the Blackfeet, the Métis, the Salish, the Kootenai, and in Montana to the Kiowa and the Cheyenne and the Comanche, going down into the Southern Plains. Lots of tribes are represented, and some of them are scholars. Some of them are doing important academic work about that, including Rosalind LaPierre, who teaches in Illinois. So, you know, it wasn't a question of centering them. That has a kind of almost artificial thing to it. It's sort of saying, of course, you know, we've been thinking about this project for 3 or 4 decades, and I'm glad we waited, because I think I hope we're better filmmakers, but we had that ability to say, yes, let's let these people. I mean, it's like you go to a doctor, you know, or two doctors, you need an operation. One doctor has performed this operation 600 times. Another one has performed it 3 or 4 or 5 times. Which doctor do you want? We went and spoke to the Native people because they knew, as did the other scholars that fill the film. They know what happened, and they know the story.
You mentioned Rosalind LaPierre, the professor at the University of Illinois. I'll be speaking with her as part of the program in which this interview is going to be. Can you talk about her role in the film and her scholarship?
She's wonderful. She gave us an amazing interview. It's just, she's a huge part of the film visually. The things she has to say come with such force and such authority. And I think it comes because she is a Blackfeet Métis, but also because she is a scholar and a historian and understands this. And I had a wonderful experience with her and another Native American woman walking up in the national, what was the Bison Refuge is now the Buffalo Refuge, and has been given over from the federal government to the Salish Kootenai tribes. And we were walking along in this place, and they were both of them engaging their scholarly knowledge. They're both scholars, but they were also talking about the particular flora and fauna that we saw, the flora and how in disturbed areas the certain thing grew and how you look for this and the medicinal properties of that. And so it was just a revelation. You know, we think we're just walking out on a trail, you know, in the plains, in the Rocky Mountains. And it's so much more. So it's thrilling. And I've now been on the road with Roz. I was with her last night in Washington, D.C., you know, speaking to a large number of people about the film, showing clips. And she's just phenomenal. She's great. What a great addition to our film.
This miniseries was written by Dayton Duncan, who's one of your longtime collaborators. His past credits include The National Parks and Lewis and Clark. And when you think of that, the connections to the Buffalo are self-evident. You mentioned working on this for, I don't know if you said years or decades, but...
But we were thinking about it. We'd made a film together on the history of the West and then on Lewis and Clark and then the National Parks, did stuff on the Dust Bowl. But we'd always wanted to do a standalone to complement biographies we'd done of human beings. And biographies are themselves kind of constituent building blocks of the larger series. And it was just bandwidth. It was not any lack of interest. Some films we say yes to and we start right away. This one, I'm really glad it incubated, but it comes a lot of it. It comes out of Dayton's passion and Dayton's research and Dayton's scholarship. And that's why we sort of do what you rarely do is we film him along with all the other people because he's such an important other edition. And I do the interview and I don't, you know, we cut him out. He doesn't care how much he's in, but you know, he's passionate and he's often off camera because it's so emotional for him that he's beginning to break down.
A lot of your work, I think if you just look at the title, it can seem to celebrate the best parts of American history, right? Jazz, baseball, the war. Obviously you deal with the darker sides of that. Racism is obviously a through line through much of that internment of Japanese citizens in the war. Recently, though, there have been a number of films that really center, if you will, there's that word again, some of the darkest aspects of American history, the U.S. and the Holocaust, the Vietnam War, the handling of the Vietnam War, and the American Buffalo. It's really not, for most of it, a positive story. And I wonder, we're in this period of shamelessness, right, where at least it seems like many Americans are enthralled to shamelessness. Do you think that we've lost our national capacity for shame and thinking about the shame?
No, I think of course things become political footballs. We're in it for the long haul, right? We're not subscribing to theories. We're not making arguments. We're telling stories. And the novelist Richard Powers says the best arguments in the world won't change anybody's point of view. The only thing that can do that is a good story. And we just want to tell good stories. And it's all complicated. It's not recently turning to darker stuff. You know, the Civil War is the worst moment in American history. We killed and murdered 750,000 of our own. You know, many of our founding fathers were slave owners. They owned other human beings, just as they were proclaiming to the world that all men were created equal. There's some rough stuff in our story, and there continues to be rough stuff in our story. But always we look for the better angels of our nature. Always we point out, particularly in the buffalo, that this is a parable of de-extinction. We saved the buffalo. We woke up in time. It is not going extinct. And the people who did it are a motley collection of people, some of whom did it for the wrong reasons. And I couldn't believe two films in a row on the Holocaust and Buffalo would bring up eugenics, this pseudoscience that was trying to categorize, you know, that you could create a hierarchy of races and ethnicities and even nationalities, which is just cuckoo. There's only one race, the human race, and everybody's the same. Everybody has the same flaws. It's true of Native Americans. It's true of Black Americans. It's true of White Americans. It's true, as one person says in a film we're working on the American Revolution, of the Laplander. You know, so this is the story of human nature is to be both greedy but also generous, to be virtuous, but to be filled with vice, to be purient, but also to be pure. And so these are not just between people, there's sometimes wars and battles within us. That makes the best kind of storytelling. When you watch the people in this film who are not fixed in one place, Quanah, the leader of the Quahada Band of Comanches, goes from being a warrior to being a man of peace. It leads his people onto the reservation and helps them transit into that, becomes friends with people who used to fight, helped to convince TR to create the Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge. I mean, Charlie Goodnight, one of his friends, was an Indian killer and a buffalo killer and became friends and saved Buffalo at the suggestion of his wife. TR moves a little bit. He's very beginning. He says, well, it's too bad the buffalo is going extinct, but it's going to be for the good because it'll help us solve our Indian question and help the advance of this white nation. You know, I mean, it's right there and there. Some of the themes that were, you know, kind of struggling with today. So I think we always kind of pull the alarm at the present moment, you know, and I've been making films about, you know, stuff that is, I mean, our Civil War was a sectional war. It wasn't a civil war. People like to use the cliche brother against brother. It happened a few times, but a revolution, that's a civil war, right? Where families, every town, 25%, maybe 30%, maybe more were loyalists, people killing their neighbors, vice versa, over whether you're a patriot or a loyalist. It's pretty rough stuff. And that makes for interesting stories. But I think what we've always felt is that we wanted to make sure that this was in the service, not of just the gratuitous violence, but in the service of what might be higher, what could invoke the better angels of our nature, what does happen when people get together, how, whatever their motives might be, and try to figure out how to save, in the case of this film, this, the most magnificent mammal on the continent.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guest. Ken Burns is one of the preeminent American documentary filmmakers. His latest work, which premiered on PBS stations this fall, is The American Buffalo. I spoke with him in October. We're going to hear more from him after the break and later in the program. My conversation with University of Illinois professor Roslyn LaPierre, who is featured in The American Buffalo. I spoke with her at a live event at Illinois Public Media this fall. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Ken Burns. His latest documentary, The American Buffalo, premiered on PBS this fall, and it's still available on the PBS Passport app. I spoke with Burns in October, and before the break, we were talking about some of Burns' past work and the way it deals with the complexities and nuances and sometimes the darker stories from American history. You've described a very complex American history, right? And I think there's an impulse in America right now to simplify. You were right, yeah. 1776 or 1619. It's a binary.
It's not, there's no binary anything, you know, that's all we want to do. You're absolutely right. We want to, you know, make it, Brian, you know, red state, blue state, young, old, rich, poor, black, white, gay, straight. You tell me, we'll make a binary thing so that we can always create an other. But, you know, as you often find, the evangelical preacher is himself looking, is gay, and it, you know, and it gets caught. These things, this is what human nature is about. It's always complicated. And the simplification is just the tool of autocrats. You know, Jefferson says it himself. You know, the very flaw of Jefferson is wrote this magnificent declaration that he couldn't live up to in its most important sentence. But he says, all experience has shown that mankind are disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable. That tells you that, you know, for all of human history, we've been under the boot of an autocrat, and we're trying something else, something new. And guess what? It's going to take a little bit of extra effort. And you know what? It's not going to be simple. It can't be reductionist. It can't be binary. It's not going to be one thing or the other. It's going to be a complex set of things. And what makes the Constitution, which is the shortest constitution on earth, so remarkable, it's kind of an operating manual, and it's very few pages, is that it is trying to understand that essential duality that people always are imposing on things, and to try to find ways to reconcile them. And whenever we're out of balance as a country, it's because we've forgotten some of the essential guardrails and safeguards and checks and balances that help kind of create the important stasis that allows us to go forward. I know that sounds, you know, like a contradiction in terms, but you need to have institutions. And three great crises before now have been the Civil War and the Depression and the World War II, but nobody worried about free and fair elections, peaceful transfer of power, or the independence of the judiciary, all of which are being talked about now, which to me sounds a lot of alarms about how critical this moment is, and that complexity is the only answer to have a rich and inclusive history, not one that's selecting only these kind of banal trivialities and Valentines to the United States when it's more complicated. If you think we are exceptional, as I do, it requires vigorous and rigorous self-examination and self-criticism. Tom Brady doesn't just rest on his laurels to stay the greatest quarterback of all time. He is constantly working, and he's working harder than you or me at what he's doing. And that's the essence of exceptionalism. So if you want to say the greatest country on earth, what will you do to make sure that it is? And introspection, self-criticism is at the heart of it. And inclusion, saying, yeah, you know what? Let's also tell that story. You don't diminish the tapestry by lifting up the corner and sweeping out some of the dirt. In fact, it's realer, and it's familiar to people. And the stories that are told are riveting, and you can't get enough of them, and it isn't made up. This isn't Hollywood. You know, that's the best thing. People always think, oh, you know, when are you going to start making feature films, as if this is the lower rung on a career ladder. I mean, I'm keeping my day job. It's great. If I were given 1,000 years to live, I'd never run out of topics in American history.
Introspection and inclusion across 36 films. Ken Burns, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.